Hello there. Today is Tuesday, November 14th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, fresh sexual assault allegations are rocking a crucial U.S. Senate campaign.
He said, "You're just a child." And he said, "I am the district attorney of Etowah County. And if you tell anyone about this, no one will ever believe you."
President Trump is wrapping up a major trip to Asia. The recovery continues from a massive earthquake in the Middle East, and alternative baseball helping kids with disabilities feel whole. It's all on today's International Edition. Well, Senate Republicans openly discussed expelling Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore if he wins next month's special election after a woman accused the Republican hopeful of sexually assaulting her when she was 16. Beverly Young Nelson cried at a New York news conference as she alleged that Moore assaulted her in his car in the late 1970s when she was a student working in a restaurant he frequented.
The area was dark and it was deserted. I was alarmed and I immediately asked him what he was doing. Instead of answering my questions, Mr. Moore reached over and began groping me and putting his hands on my breasts.
Four other women accused Moore of sexual misconduct when they were teenagers in an article published last week by the Washington Post. Moore held a news conference after the latest accuser came forward. Standing alongside his wife, he emphatically denied the allegations.
"I can tell you without hesitation, this is absolutely false. I never did what she said I did. I don't even know the woman. I don't know anything about her. I don't even know where the restaurant is or was."
Well, the issue of sexual assault and harassment in America is continuing to come out of the shadows in recent weeks, following revelations several weeks ago about Hollywood movie producer Harvey Weinstein. Joining me now to discuss is Mike Domish, founder and executive director of the Date Safe Project. Thank you for being with us. So are you surprised by these latest allegations against Senate candidate Roy Moore?
Sadly, not surprised, because typically when this occurs, it isn't a one-time thing. People have a track record of behavior that abuses power against others. And that's what sexual assault is. It's abusing power. And that's why the age part here is important to discuss. You're talking somebody in their 30s, and the people who have come forward have talked about being in their teens. And so that there's a clear, large gap in age there. Also, his position and what he was in the community, there's multiple levels of power that someone in his role could use over people and abuse.
So would you say that it's more likely in situations like this, when there are numerous women coming forward, that they are more credible than the accused?
Well, sadly, our country seems to require multiple survivors to come forward before they believe the first one, two, or three. And that's really sad, because imagine being the survivor who has the courage to come forward, and until more come forward, you're not believed. It's why survivors don't come forward often. When people say, "Why did people wait 40 years? Look how people are acting now when multiple people are coming forward. And we're in a very different place culturally today than we were 20 years ago, 30 years ago, or 40 years ago. And we're more supportive of survivors, and yet we still have a long ways to go. Back then, it was immediately often put on the survivor, and there was victim blaming, as there has been in this case, but it was automatic, with almost nobody defending the survivor back then. So it was very hard to come forward.
Right. He has called this a witch hunt, Democratic agenda, you know, you name it. But she came forward and said, "Look, I'm a Donald Trump supporter. You know, this is not Democrat or Republican issue." And she was clearly distraught having to relive it.
Well, and that's really important to discuss. Whenever you have a case of sexual violence, the accused is always going to fight back with more detail than the person it happened to, because the accused is trying to clear their name, and they could potentially say whatever they have to say to clear their name. So they will become much more attack-oriented compared to the survivor who's telling their story. So you get two very different approaches on what you'll hear, and it should not be a surprise that you're hearing attack, attack, attack. The goal is to sadly discredit the survivor, the person who's already been traumatized. That's the disgusting part of these cases.
It's really interesting that ever since the situation with movie producer Harvey Weinstein came to light and more and more people came out accusing him. And then, as we've seen, many more celebrities, the accusations have come in against people with positions of power. It sort of exploded in the United States. I mean, it started with anyone who's ever been sexually harassed or assaulted, you know, the whole hashtag Me Too. We're talking like this, not a reality that just started last week. This is a reality for like half the population.
That's correct. And one thing we need to keep in mind as we watch, for instance, the Me Too campaign, it's still evidence of how difficult it is to come forward, because many people who hashtag Me Too are in no way proceeding forward with legal cases, right? So while everybody out there is saying, well, why didn't they legally do this? Why didn't they? Well, look at the Me Too campaign. These are people saying this happened to me, yet I'm not going to the police. I'm not doing this because there could be a multitude of reasons. It could be that too much time has passed, but it could also be I'm not ready to go through that, or I may never be ready to go through that myself, and how difficult that is. And this is a great example, because in this case, the Roy Moore case, another person down in Alabama said the survivors should actually be charged with a crime because they didn't come forward. I mean, think about how sick and twisted that is, that if you're a survivor out there and you hear that, you think, oh my gosh, they're going to turn the law against me for what a criminal did to me. I mean, that's so sick and twisted, but it shows you how quick people will victim blame just to not want to deal with the reality of this happening.
Why do you think this is so prevalent in the United States?
Oh, it's worldwide. The difference is we're having the conversation. I get to work all over the world on this topic, and sexism, abuse of power, is a worldwide issue. The difference is that when the Harvey Weinstein case came forward, what happened was people realized I'm not alone. Other survivors are coming forward. I'm not alone. There's a safe space for me potentially to share my story. And in the past, I didn't think there was a safe space. Now there is. And let's keep in mind, for every Me Too that was used, there's one, two, maybe up to 10 for every Me Too that somebody didn't put Me Too, because they're still afraid and scared to share that story out there. So as big as it was, it still doesn't even come close to covering how much has happened in our society. Keep in mind, this is an abuse of power, and that can be done by any gender. In this case, we are looking more at male perpetrators, and can be done to any gender, any identity.
Do you feel like, though, we are making a shift in awareness and therefore, you know, with all these women now feeling empowered to come forward, that we could be on the precipice of some real change here?
For survivors, yes. For the actual behavior and cultural attitudes, no. Well, the reason I say that is I believe that this is a very empowering moment for survivors to know you are supported and that you can feel safer to come forward and get the support you deserve. This could be a tipping point for that to happen. But nobody's discussing culturally how we got here, how we have a sexual world where people think they can just make their move on another human being. And in the case here with Roy Moore, they talk about drove around the back of the restaurant and just started doing these things. If you talk to people sexually in the dating world and say, have you ever experienced that? Almost everybody's like, well, of course I've experienced that. That's how some people make their move. Until we start having that conversation about respecting boundaries, consent, what it means to have a mutually amazing relationship, we're still not tackling the issue. We're putting Band-Aids to help that heal wound for survivors, but we're not stopping the injury from being committed in the first place.
All right, that's Mike Domish, founder and executive director of DateSafe, the DateSafe Project. Thanks for being with us. And turning now to the latest on what's trending on social media, Andrew Palchewski's here, and this story that we've been talking about really taking a life of its own on social media.
Related to those Roy Moore allegations,
right.
People are taking to social media to put them in context using hashtag MeAt14, and they're using that hashtag and posting photos of themselves at age 14 to show what these girls might have looked like back when they were allegedly in relationships with Moore, and to visually depict that a 14-year-old is too young to consent to a relationship. So we're seeing many women describing what they were doing at 14. I've seen tweets that say, oh, I was in Girl Scouts, I was on a sports team, I was getting good grades in school, I was, you know, braiding my friend's hair at sleepovers. And many of those tweets ending with the same declaration, I was not dating a 32-year-old man. So people putting that in context, using their own personal experiences to show that, and people using their personal experiences from some very dark instances. There are some people using this hashtag to describe how they were sexually harassed or even sexually assaulted at age 14, further raising awareness about those issues, which of course have dominated the headlines over the past month.
Right. I mean, just recently we had the whole, you know, when people really started talking about the Harvey Weinstein, the movie producer, and then sexual assault, and everyone's been talking about it. And then the Me Too hashtag was just a couple of weeks ago, and now this. So it's interesting to see how social media is really making it a lot harder for people to hide things.
People are referring to it as the Weinstein effect. So social media has really given a lot of women, as well as men, who have experienced sexual harassment or abuse, a platform to speak out about these allegations and instances and really share their stories to do some good.
All right, Andrew. Thanks so much. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A UN agency report shows Iran meeting its nuclear commitments. Civilians caught in the middle as South Sudan's war nears the four-year mark. On the Russian meddling in U.S. election, where do Trump and the U.S. intelligence community stand? And the FBI says hate crimes increased by 4.6% in 2016. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. In a series of meetings with other Asia-Pacific region leaders Monday, President Trump discussed security cooperation and deepening trade ties. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman reports from Manila, the capital of the Philippines, and the last stop on the president's five-nation 12-day trip.
The annual Leaders Summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations have a reputation as a talk shop with a priority on consensus and performances expressing regional harmony, meaning little of substance usually emerges. The news tends to get made on the sidelines when presidents and prime ministers hold one-on-one talks. President Trump on Monday added one notable face, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, who hosted Trump in Tokyo earlier this month, to his scheduled discussion with Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull.
We've got the same values and the same focus on ensuring that the North Korean regime comes to its senses and stops its reckless provocation of and threats of conflict in our region. Peace and stability have underpinned the prosperity of billions of people over many decades, and we're going to work together to ensure we maintain it.
Underscoring that, a massive naval drill involving three U.S. aircraft carrier strike groups now underway in Western Pacific waters. The U.S. naval vessels and aircraft are joined by elements of the South Korean Navy and Japanese Maritime Self-Defense Force. Trump says he will make a major statement covering North Korea and trade Wednesday after he returns to the White House.
And a lot of great things have happened for our country and I think for the world. A lot of elements were solved or in the process of being solved.
The president says $300 billion of sales by American companies have been generated during his journey. It appears that much of that amount, however, is derived from non-binding memoranda of understanding signed in Beijing and Hanoi. Not everyone was happy to see Trump and the other leaders in town. Several thousand militant protesters clashed with riot police who responded with truncheons, water cannons, and sonic alarms to keep the demonstration out of sight of the delegates. There were some injuries and a few arrests. Protesters shouted for Trump to leave and accused the United States, a former colonial ruler of the Philippines, of looking for overseas wars. One notable accomplishment out of the ASEAN Leaders Summit, the group has finally decided, after years of talking but little action, to formally negotiate a code of conduct for the South China Sea, where several countries have conflicting territorial claims. Steve Herman, VOA News, Manila.
Well, in an earthquake that struck Sunday along the Iraq-Iran border has killed more than 400 people and injured thousands, the U.S. Geological Survey said the earthquake was a magnitude 7.3 with a center near the town of Halabja in Iraq's Kurdistan region. International Edition's Sarah Williams spoke with Yassin Abbas, president of the Iraq Red Crescent Society.
The risk rescuing those who were under the wreckage, second, first aid on the spot, and the third, transportation by ambulance transportation to the hospital. Hospital care, of course, took place there for wounded and some operations for fixing the fractures, broken arms, legs, and treating the wounds and some of the patients are still in the hospital, some being discharged after receiving the initial treatment in the hospital. So these were the main services on the spot and initially. Then we also provided shelters for those who have been displaced from the damaged houses and providing food with psychosocial support.
Is your organization, do you just stay strictly on the Iraq side of the border? Are you able to go into Iran at all?
Yeah, we can, of course, if they call for us. But I think the Iranian Red Crescent, they already managed to provide support to their people. And we are here, you know, we are not only dealing with the recent earthquake victims, but we have more than 3 million people being displaced during the 4 years of conflict with ISIS. So we have also a big task here in Iraq, besides what we have now for the earthquake victims.
I understand that the earthquake has cut power and telephone service to a number of towns, which has made the rescue effort more difficult.
Yeah, it was for a while, only for a while, actually, not more than 10 to 15 minutes, even in Baghdad, the phone calls or the phone connection cut. But it's now very normal, and we are communicating with our staff in the affected areas.
All right. Is there anything else you would like to say or you'd like me to ask you?
I'd like just to add that we have received a very good support from Turkish Red Crescent, and this morning, there was an airplane loaded with aids landed in Sulaymaniyah Airport, and we have been also informed that a big convoy will be crossing the border from Turkey to Iraq, loaded with a big amount of aids to Iraqi defense to manage to support its relief operation in the area.
All right, that was Yassine Abbas, president of the Iraqi Red Crescent Society. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports.
I love Sunny Side of Sports.
Please join us for a whole half hour of sports talk and news Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC GMT. On the internet, you can like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Visit voaafrica.com and enjoy the show.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, baseball is the all-American sport, and it often inspires children at a very young age to join Little League teams. But if you have a disability, that can often be a hindrance. Joining me now is someone who could have let his own disability discourage him, but instead turned it into a way to help other people. Taylor Duncan is the commissioner and director of the Alternative Baseball Organization. Taylor, thanks so much for being with us. First of all, just tell us exactly what is the Alternative Baseball Organization?
We do it through structured practices catered to everyone's skill level. We do exhibition games with real umpires for a professional feel, all the way down to the major league rules, even with the wood bats, all in a structured social environment for all to be the best they can be and to be accepted for who they are.
How did you come up with the idea?
Well, I was diagnosed with autism myself when I was 4, and I went through speech issues, anxiety issues, social stigma associated with having autism. Coaches didn't want me on their team because they presumed that I was an injury risk because of having autism. But I've also had really positive experiences thanks to the help from my mother, family, teachers, mentors, and others who have helped me through the years. I've been able to get to where I am today which is to hopefully raise awareness and acceptance for autism and special needs.
So how does it work? How many people are on the team? Who do you play?
Right now, I want to say we have around 25 players who have signed on with, and we started in January of 2016 with around 7 or 8, and now we're up to around 25. And next, we're looking at developing an expansion program. November the 11th, we're having the Alternative Baseball All-Star Game, the big event that we have each year, starring our players with autism and special needs who have played in and came to 70% or more of the practices in the games. They get to play with and against professional baseball players from leagues all over the world.
Wow, that's a pretty big deal.
Thank you. And it's going to be live streamed, too, for those outside of Atlanta.
Do you know of any of the names of some of the baseball players that are going to be playing?
The former Brave, Anthony LaRue, who pitched for the Braves from 2006 to 2008. And then we have former Cub Bobby Scales, who played with the Cubs in 09 and has played a couple of years in the Japanese Nippon professional baseball. And we also have the current manager of the Atlanta Braves, Brian Snitker, who was signed on to help these other communities and neighborhoods around the world who have come to us for help and starting their own programs and those wanting to join our Alternative Baseball Network. We're really working on getting that up and going for 2018.
Have all your players been diagnosed with autism?
Not all of our players are on the spectrum. We have one with fetal alcohol syndrome, and we have one with Down syndrome. And then we have some with ADHD. Mm-hmm. Really, it's opened up.
Who do you guys play? Like, what team? Do you play other teams?
We usually split our groups up, and we usually pick around and recruit different players of various levels of experience to come to our game to participate and help our players develop. We've had players who have just played Little League and slow pitch all the way up to the professional level.
Do you feel like you're really making a difference, and do you see results?
I hope so. I know that I've personally seen a lot of it. Not only helps them, but it helps me too, because I'm learning to become a leader every single day I'm running this organization.
What are some of the people that join say about any difference it's made in their life?
A lot of them have seen remarkable differences, whether it be their social life or they're playing in the real game for the first time.
I really wish you all the best in expanding it to other places and helping more people.
Thank you very much. We're looking at one day growing this globally, worldwide, and that's what we really want to do. That's our end goal.
All right. Taylor Duncan is the commissioner and director of the Alternative Baseball Organization. Thanks so much for being with us. A new film starring Oscar nominees Gary Oldman and Kristen Scott Thomas tells the story of Winston Churchill as he becomes Prime Minister of Britain. As VOA's David Berg tells us, Darkest Hour is generating a lot of Oscar buzz for Goldman's portrayal.
Why have I been forced to send for Churchill?
His record is a catastrophe.
Let me see your true qualities, your lack of vanity.
Yeah, my lion will.
Your sense of humor.
Ho, ho, ho.
Your Majesty.
It is my duty to invite you to take up the position of Prime Minister of this United Kingdom.
It's 1940, and British forces are trapped in the tiny French town of Dunkirk as a German invasion of Britain seems imminent. King Edward VI, played in Darkest Hour by Golden Globe nominee and Emmy winner Ben Mendelsohn, calls on Winston Churchill to become Prime Minister. Churchill must battle not only the Nazis, but also forces in his own cabinet that seek appeasement with Adolf Hitler. Gary Oldman said at the film's release at the Toronto Film Festival that he hesitated to play an historical character that people know, and one who has been played in other productions by such powerful actors as Brian Cox in Churchill and John Lithgow in The Crown.
You're not only in the shadow of the great man, but you're also in the shadow of great actors who have played him. But I came around, I thought, what's the worst that could happen? I could be really awful in it. That's the worst that could happen. So I jumped off the cliff.
Oldman's performance has been generating buzz as a possible Best Actor candidate come Oscar time. His only previous Oscar nomination was for 2012's Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy. Kristen Scott Thomas plays Clementine Churchill, who helps encourage the new PM as he faces cabinet battles over appeasement, even as Hitler's forces gather on the French coast. Thomas says the film shows that leaders, even great ones, are human, but can do extraordinary things.
What is extraordinary about Winston Churchill is that he was an historian, and so he had a huge knowledge of the past and could understand how things worked and how history repeats itself, and was able to sort of foresee certain things that that is what made him an extraordinary leader.
We're facing certain defeat on land, the annihilation of our army, and imminent invasion. We must negotiate peace talks.
When will the lesson be learned? You cannot reason with a tiger when your head is in its mouth!
This film does share some similarities with Brian Cox's Churchill. It is told from the perspective of a young secretary, Elizabeth Layton, played by Lily James, whom fans will remember as Rose from the hit television drama Downton Abbey. But Darkest Hour does take a non-historical detour when Churchill leaves his motorcade on his way to Parliament to take a journey on the Tube. That's where he meets several people who inspire his "We Will Fight Them on the Beaches" speech. Darkest Hour is directed by Oscar nominee Joe Wright and written by Anthony McCartan, who co-wrote the Oscar-nominated Stephen Hawking biopic, The Theory of Everything. Darkest Hour opens in U.S. theaters November 22nd. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Greg Burns. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On his recent trip to South Korea, President Donald Trump and President Moon Jae-in discussed joint efforts to confront the grave threat posed by North Korea's illegal nuclear weapons and missile programs. President Trump said, "We cannot allow North Korea to threaten all that we have built. Our alliance is more important than ever to peace and security on the Korean Peninsula and across the Indo-Pacific region." North Korea's sixth test of a nuclear weapon and its missile launches are threats not only to the people of South Korea, but to people all across the globe. We will together confront North Korea's actions and prevent the North Korean dictator from threatening millions of innocent lives, said President Trump. The president called on every responsible nation, including China and Russia, to demand that the North Korean regime end its nuclear weapons and its missile programs and live in peace. All nations must implement UN Security Council resolutions and cease trade and business entirely with North Korea, said President Trump. It is unacceptable that nations would help to arm and finance this increasingly dangerous regime. As both countries work together to resolve this problem using all available tools short of military action, the United States stands prepared to defend itself and its allies using the full range of its unmatched military capabilities. President Trump observed that in the more than six decades since we signed our mutual defense treaty, our alliance has grown stronger and deeper. Our two nations symbolize what independent countries can accomplish when they serve the interests of their people, respect the sovereignty of their neighbors, and uphold the rule of law. The possibilities are amazing, said President Trump, for a Korean peninsula liberated from the threat of nuclear weapons, where all Koreans could enjoy the blessings of liberty and the prosperity that you have achieved right here in South Korea. Together, said President Trump, our two nations will handle threats to peace and security, stand up to those who would threaten our freedom, and boldly seize the incredible opportunities for a better, brighter, and more prosperous tomorrow.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.